So, after all the divine nostalgia. Oh, we have a program, right?
Yep.
As they say, you have to sing for your supper.
To go to work.
What's that?
I asked to organize
the mic. Oh.
It's not too close and threatening. I feel very human.
Yeah, that's good. They don't want the food, actually. To give them food. Hare Krishna.
Welcome to Maharaj. Hare Krishna.
So, Gunavatar Prabhu, what is tonight's... Do we have kirtan first?
It can be very nice.
Yeah, who will sing?
You will sing? You will chant?
I guess I could try.
Yes.
This is like Harish has talent. Who are the judges so I know who I have to... Do they have Israel has talent? Israel's got talent? So our next contestant is a sannyasi.
Maharaj, people in immigration council. So we accept your talent.
Immigration. So, there are cartels? Oh, I have one. Oh, we have to walk again and then golf course. Golf guitar. I have to say this, actually. Prabhupada liked my kartal playing. One time we... he was recording that tape, Songs of the Vaishnavacharyas. And so he asked me to play kartals from that song, Paramakaruna. And the next day he wanted me to play again. Hope I haven't lost it. Namo Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prishtaya Bhutale Srimate Bhakti Vedanta Samiti Namine Nama Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prishtaya Bhutale Srimate Bhakti Vedanta Samiti Gauravani Pracharine Nirvishesha Shunyavadi Asatya Desha Tarine Namaste Sarasati Deva Gauravani Pracharine Jayati Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Jayadeva Gadadhara Sivasati Gaura Jai Prabhupada. Gaur Prema Nandi Hari Hari Ho. Gaur Prema Nandi, you've heard that, right? That actually means Hari, like let us glorify Hari, who is in the ecstasy of Gaura Prema, the love of Lord Chaitanya's love. Gaura Prema Anandi Hari. It's that Hari in the form in which he experiences the ecstatic love of Lord Chaitanya. So, thank you all for coming. L'chaim. So, do we have a Bhagavad Gita in the house? Toda. Why not? So, this is chapter 5 of Bhagavad Gita, text 23. Actually, 22 is good too. There's a whole okay, let's read this section. This is like a let's start with text 18, and then there's a whole, you could say, argument or a whole explanation Krishna's giving us, something very important. So he begins by saying, Vidya Vinaya Sampanne Brahmane Gavihastini Shuni Chaiva Shapakecha Pandita Samadarshanaha. So the Panditas, the wise people, they see equally, sama. Sama is just the English word same, equal. So, and darshinaha, samadarshina. So they see these things equally, or they have equal vision when they see vidya vinaya sampanne brahmane. A brahmana, but not any ordinary brahman that just, you know, rings a bell for money, but a Brahman who's actually endowed with vidya, knowledge, learning, and vinaya, humility. Of course, we're still working on that one. But so, in other words, Krishna starts out by giving the highest human being, or the highest living being on earth, because human beings, for good or evil, are the govern this planet. So of all living beings on earth, the highest is a truly qualified Brahman, one who is endowed. Sampanna means endowed or gifted with vidya, wisdom and humility. And then Gavi, a cow, or Hastini, an elephant. Hasta means hand, and so the elephant's trunk is called a hand, so that elephant is called Hasti, one who has a hand, and that's where you get Hastinapura, the city with elephants. So Gavi, a cow, Hastini, an elephant, Shuni, a dog, or, and this is kind of gross, Shwapakecha, or a dog cooker. It's, don't try this at home. So, the idea here is that among the human beings, we've gone from the top to the bottom. The idea, obviously, being all human beings. Because between the learned, humble brahmana and the dog cooker, literally, that's the full range of human types. And then we get the animals. And again, we have the cow, the elephant, the dog. And so really the idea here is all living beings. So Krishna says the wise see all of these equally. I mean, clearly, in one sense, they're equal, and another sense, they're not. Because if they were all absolutely equal, we wouldn't have different names for them, right? So, the fact that they're different is obvious. The fact that requires more spiritual depth is that they're one. That's more difficult to see. Precisely because the differences are so obvious. And yet there's a spiritual oneness because they're all spiritual beings. So this is this sama, equal or the same, equal vision, samadarshina, is a major theme in the Bhagavad Gita. We just published the Bhagavad Gita. Actually, the first copies arrived already in America, and hopefully they'll come here very soon. But I talk about how much Krishna discusses this equality, which is a big thing nowadays, right? Equality. For example, Krishna says that samatvam yoga uchate. Yoga is defined as samatvam, equality. Like seeing everyone equal, being fair to everyone, and so on. So, and then Krishna, so he's going to, well, actually I'll read Prabhupada's purport, and then we'll go on. First of all, Prabhupada's translation, the humble sages, by virtue of true knowledge, see with equal vision a learned and gentle Brahman, a cow, an elephant, a dog, and a dog-eater, an outcast. A Krishna-conscious person makes no distinction between species or castes. In India, this is a huge thing. Well, in Israel and other countries also. In America, there definitely are social distinctions. The Brahman and the outcast may be different from the social point of view, or a dog, a cow, and an elephant may be different from the point of view of species, but these differences of body are meaningless from the viewpoint of a learned transcendentalist, in other words, someone who's seeing beyond the body. This is due to the relationship of all these creatures to the Supreme. For the Supreme Lord, by his plenary portion as Paramatma, is present in everyone's heart. Such an understanding of the Supreme is real knowledge. As far as bodies are concerned, in different castes or different species of life, the Lord is equally kind to everyone because he treats every living being as a friend, yet maintains himself as Paramatma regardless of the circumstances of the living entities. The Lord as Paramatma is present both in the outcast and in the Brahman, although the body of a Brahman and the body of an outcast are not the same. The bodies are material productions of different modes of material nature, but the soul and super soul within the body are of the same spiritual quality. The similarity in the quality of the soul and the super soul, however, does not make them equal in quantity, for the individual soul is present only in that particular body, whereas the Paramatma is present in each and every body. A Krishna-conscious person has full knowledge of this, and therefore he is truly learned and has equal vision. The similar characteristics of the soul and supersoul are that they are both conscious, eternal, and blissful. But the difference is that the individual soul is conscious within the limited jurisdiction of the body, whereas the super soul is conscious of all bodies, which is what Krishna says actually in chapter 13. That kshetra jang chapi mang vidhi sarva kshetra ishu bharata, know me to be the knower of all bodies. So, the super soul is present in all bodies without distinction. So we're talking about this equality. Then Krishna goes on to say, "Ihai vitair jita sargo jeshang sangye stitang manaha." Very interesting. This means that those people have conquered jita, like jaya. They have conquered sarga. Sarga means creation, and so it means conquering your life in the material world that's created and destroyed. That means conquering the creation of your own material bodies, so you escape karma and samsara. So that's what Krishna says literally, that those people have conquered sarga, or creation. Those people whose mind is situated in samya, equality. Sama, equal. Samya, equality. Or sameness. So this is interesting. First, Krishna says that those who are really panditas, those who are wise, see equally all the different souls and different bodies. And if your mind, stita, is just English stand, situated, sta in Sanskrit, sta, English stand, same word. So if your mind is really standing, it's fixed in this equality, then you have conquered creation. In other words, you are beyond the material creation, and you're beyond the creation of more material bodies for yourself. And then Krishna says, nirdosham hi samang brahma. This is why this equality is so important, because Brahma, the absolute truth, is itself equal. Very interesting statement. This whole section of the Gita, Krishna is really talking about equality, what it means to be equal. And because he says that, because Brahma, indeed, is equal. It's equal to everyone, because God is equal to everyone. And Brahman is nirdosham. Dosha means, not to be confused with that South Indian food, dosas, or the Ayurvedic doshas. This is an older Sanskrit dosha, which means a fault. It's like in Sanskrit, there are two antonyms, opposite words. Guna means a good quality, and then dosha means a bad quality, or a fault, a flaw, a mistake, something like that. So, nirdosham. Flawless, without imperfection. And therefore, if you become equal, if you see Krishna everywhere, then you are like Brahman, because Brahman is like that, and therefore you are situated in Brahman. It's very interesting. Things equal to the same thing are equal to each other. So if you stand in oneness, If you stand in equality, you stand in Brahman, because Brahman is equal. So it's in other words, if I hate someone, then I separate myself from God, because God doesn't hate anyone. I mean, he definitely realizes some people are extraordinarily obnoxious, but he doesn't hate them. He just realizes they are extraordinarily obnoxious. So therefore, let's be honest. So if I hate someone, I am separating myself from Krishna, because I am seeing the world differently than Krishna sees it.
Same for love.
What? Yes.
Same for love.
Yes. Attachment. If I'm materially attached to someone, well, love is Krishna loves. But if I'm materially attached to someone, Krishna is not materially attached to someone. So if I'm materially attached, again, I separate myself from Krishna. That's why Krishna says, I believe in chapter 3, that Shreyan Dravya Maya Dyagya Jnana Dyagya Parantapa Sarvam Karma Kilam Partha Jnane Parisamapyate. That better than just offering me material things like, hi Krishna, need some incense? Or, I'm not saying we shouldn't offer those things, but if we just offer Krishna like incense or water, or here's this or that, but we don't offer him our heart and our consciousness. It's like, for example, let's say that two people have a relationship, and one of them offers, oh, here's a little gift, here's some flowers, here's some candy, but I don't agree with you, and I see everything differently than you do, but here's some candy. You know, knock yourself out. So the real point is, there has to be a meeting of minds. So Krishna says, better than just offering me material things, dravya, which means a material object, paraphernalia, better than that, offer me your consciousness, in the sense that learn to see the world as I see it. So if you see the world as Krishna sees it, you don't hate anyone, and you're not materially attached to anyone. You certainly love, But material attachment is not love. It's taking, not giving. So then Krishna goes on to say, like in practice, what does it mean to have this equal vision, this to be samadarshi, to have equal vision, or to be situated in equality and therefore to be situated in the absolute, because the absolute is equal. Krishna says, na prahrishyet priyam prapya, that priyam prapya, prapya on achieving something, on getting something you like, priya, which like English word pleasure, on getting something you like, don't get excited. The word prahrisha is interesting. This, of course, is the verb hrish in Sanskrit, like harsha is a word made from that, like harsha, shoka, and so on. So it can mean rejoicing, but it also can mean literally getting excited, like a little agitated electron. You know, it's, for example, when the hairs stand on end, you know, like someone gets really excited and their hairs stand up, that's called Roma Harshana. That's where that word comes from. Roma means hair, so Roma Harsha. So Harsha can mean like rejoicing, but also in the sense of just getting really like excited. If you think about it, real pleasure is not excitement. It's a deeper pleasure and satisfaction. And so in the material world, on the mental platform, we just get excited in the sense of agitated, but then there's real spirit. So Krishna says, na prahrishyet, and the word, and the pra, everything is so interesting. Pra is a prefix meaning like strongly, or you really get into it. That's the idea. So na prahrishyet priyam prapya, don't get excited when you get something you like. And no dvijet, don't get disturbed, prapya cha apriyam, when you get something you don't like. Well, prapya is like when you come upon something, like you just, you know, you come across something, it's just in the path of your life. So when you get something you don't like, don't get disturbed. And when you get something you like, don't get all excited, like, I want to enjoy this. So that's what Krishna is saying. And then he says, sthira buddhir, steady intelligence. It's very interesting because generally the mind gets excited or depressed. But Krishna says your intelligence, buddhi, the rational faculty, your reasoning power must be steady. That's why Krishna talks about buddhi yoga. Krishna says that teshang 10.10, 10.10 Gita, teshang satata juktanam bhajatang priti purvakam, those who are always engaged, worshipping me with love. Dadami, Krishna says, what do I give them? I give them buddhi yoga. I give them intelligence, understanding by which they can come to me. Buddhi yoga. So, just as we find in Plato in the Republic, we have our senses. Krishna says in the Gita, Bhagavad Gita, see, obviously Krishna read Plato. That was a joke. So, Krishna says in the Gita, Indriyani Paranyahur, the senses are superior, which means, it Prabhupada translates, to dull matter. In other words, they're just like, you know, let's say we were so weird that I brought some human being in here, some devotee, and put him down and sat down on him, and then to make my points, I beat on his head or something. It would be extremely inappropriate. So, yeah, people would think, is he really a guru? So, but, you know, no one says, hey, you're just using that chair, right? If you say you're using that person to use another person, it's considered inappropriate. But if someone says, you're using that chair, and, yeah, using the chair, and what's the problem? So in that way, the senses, because obviously senses belong to a conscious being. And so therefore that's like the most gross or most basic level of consciousness. Just raw sensations. And you think of the word sensation and then the senses. So Krishna says the senses are superior, but then indriye vyak parang manaha. Mind is above the senses. And then manasastu parabudhir. And above the mind is intelligence. Yo budhe pratastu saha. And beyond the intelligence is the soul. So, as Plato explains, and as Krishna explains, you will have a good, sane, happy life when you get things in the right order. For example, if there's a family where the children totally control the parents, it's going to be a very strange house. If the parents are so weak that a little child, just the parents do whatever the child says. Obviously, the parents have to raise the child and take care of the child. So if your mind controls your intelligence, like, I know I shouldn't do that, but I think I will anyway. Or I know I should do that, but I don't want to. So that I want to, I don't want to, I like it, I don't like it, I feel like it, I don't feel like it. That, ladies and gentlemen, is the mind. That is the mind. I don't feel like it. But I just want to do that. Yeah, but you're going to self-destruct. But I want to do that. I want to. I feel like it. I like it. So you can see that if you're ruled by that, you're going to have a very unfortunate life. And the intelligence is more like James Bond. You know, just like calculating. Or Sherlock Holmes, elementary Dr. Watson. So, the intelligence is just sort of like this cool, calm, reasoning, seeing things as they are, figuring it out, analyzing it. That's intelligence. So to be intelligent, to be, doesn't mean you have no feelings, that you have no heart. It's like nowadays in New Age circles, it's like, oh, I don't want to get into that head trip. I don't want to hear that's just coming from your head, man. It doesn't come from your heart. Actually, God gave us both a brain and a heart, and so the heart and the brain have to be aligned. It's like because we have emotions and we have strong emotions, but Krishna makes a very interesting statement in chapter 6 of the Gita. He talks about pleasures which are buddhi grahyam, literally acceptable to intelligence. In other words, I have feelings, but those feelings have to be governed. Let's say someone has a very strong feeling like, I want to kill you. And it's because someone, I don't know, you know, is going too slow in traffic or something. And so, I mean, that's a feeling. So before we offer our obeisances to emotions, remember the half our emotions are really bizarre. And so, so let's say, for example, we have the feeling like, I want to kill that person, and it's not appropriate. And so your intelligence says, don't do it, don't do it. Or someone wants to get into a relationship, which is obviously going to be kind of like getting into one of those machines that grind up tree branches. And so... so obviously, it's not that emotions are bad, but they're good when they're properly directed, because emotions can be blind. So if your intelligence tells you, yes, you have feelings, you want to express your feelings, but here is an appropriate object for your feelings. Now, just, you know, yes, open your heart, let out your feelings, but do it in this way. Like, let's say you like to drive a car fast. Where's Tovo? Formula 108. So, it's good, actually. She gets me through traffic very efficiently. So, some people, you know, especially when you're a little younger. But when I was young, oh my God. Anyway, I won't. It's definitely yoga maya that I'm still alive. I mean, the way I used to drive, there is a God. So the point is, okay, you like to drive fast, but you also have to drive safely. You have to stay on the road. You can't just, it's not like in Hollywood where a car, you know, is like speeding 100 miles an hour, hits, goes right into a barn, like some big building, smashes through the wall, smashes out the other end, falls 20 feet and keeps going, not even a scratch on the car. You ever notice that in the Hollywood movies? Car doesn't have a scratch. Headlights are fine, everything's great. It just crashed through a building, but no problem. So if one has that feeling like I want to drive fast, but stay on the road and be careful, and when they put signs up like dangerous curve, there's a reason they put those signs up. So in that way, the intelligence keeps you on the road so that even if you have strong emotions, you don't go off the cliff. So therefore, Krishna says, sthita buddhir. Because it's like, for example, let's say a child wants something from the mother, which is really, like, you know, poison or really bad. And the child keeps crying, please, 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 all right, I love you so much. Here, you can have this poison. So the mind is begging us and threatening us and telling us, you'll never be happy without this. And so on. And so it's a question of the intelligence has to be steady, so that we remember the truth. We don't get misled. We remember the truth. So Krishna says, sthita buddhir asamudha, not bewildered. Not bewildered. Mudha, you've heard this word, we use this word in a derogatory way. Mudha literally means confused, like bewildered. Someone is foolish because... So samudha means totally confused. And so Krishna says, asamudha, not at all confused. Intelligence is steady. Then brahmavit. You understand Brahman and Brahmani, and again, Brahmanistita. Again, just like the last verse, Krishna says, Brahmanistita, you are fixed in, you live in, you exist within the Absolute. It's just like Krishna says in chapter 12 of the Gita that if you give, he says, Mayeva Mana Adatswa, fix your mind in me alone. Mayi buddhing niveshaya, dedicate your intelligence to me. To be a devotee doesn't mean you turn off your brain. It means you become more intelligent and you think for Krishna. So Krishna, if you do this, nivasishasi maya, you will live in me. This verb, nivas, from which you get the word nivasa, which means a home, a residence, where you live. And so Krishna is saying, like, that will be your address, like 108 Krishna Street. In that you will actually live, you will reside in me. And here also, in these two verses, Krishna says, you will exist in Brahman. I mean, you will be fixed in Brahman. And you will know Brahman, but you have to be like Brahman. It's just like if someone wants to come to Israel, they want to get a visa to live in Israel, and it's obvious this person is a complete loser. I mean, you know, this person, let's say, is obviously going to, you know, the day they land, they're going to immediately go on welfare and stay there for the rest of their life. And this person is going to contribute nothing to society. This person also has remarkable criminal tendencies and so on. You don't fit the profile to get a visa.
Unless you're Jewish.
Even then, I think they actually have some special clauses. Okay, so let's imagine a place that doesn't have that condition. So the more we become like... Okay, I'll give an example that works even in Israel, even among Jews. Okay, let's say you want to belong to a particular social group. Ha. Gotcha. So let's say you want to belong to a particular social group. You want to go to their parties. You want to be invited. You want them to come to your home. But let's say you just don't, you're just not there. Then you can't, even if you're Jewish, right? Because even among Jewish people in Israel, there are obviously different social groups, which are becoming, in one sense, more exaggerated. So the basic principle is, if you want to live with a particular group of people, hang out with them, you have to kind of be at their standard. And so we want to be in the absolute. Then Krishna says more about, he's still talking about the same topic. And he says, Bhayasparseshva Saktatma, you should be a soul, Atma, who is not attached to what literally external contacts. The word sparsha can mean touch, like the sense of touch, that's sparsha in Sanskrit. But it also means like contact, you know, like touching, contacting. And bahya means external. So you have to be a soul not attached to external contacts. And that, of course, refers to the senses contacting matter. My eyes see something I like or see something I don't like, or my other senses, and therefore, I mean, think of the word attached. I literally want to grab it. So Krishna says, Vindati Atmani Jatsukam. If you do not become attached to these poor girls, just sit through a lecture. God. When I was your age, I couldn't do this. I couldn't sit through a lecture, so I admire you. Anyway, so Vayasparaseshva Saktatma. Detached from the external context, then you enjoy the pleasure within. Like, let's say, for example, someone comes into your house and says, I'm here to give you, you know, a billion shekels, or dollars, or better, rubles. But anyway, let's say someone comes to give you that, but you run out of the house, and you just, like, you run away from it. So there's a treasure inside of us. That's what Krishna is saying. There's a treasure. The real pleasure, the real happiness is actually inside of us. But if our consciousness is running outside through the senses to get things out there, you never find the real treasure inside, the real happiness inside. That's what Krishna is saying. So one who enjoys the pleasure inside and is not attached outside, Sukham Akshayam Ashnute, they achieve imperishable happiness. It's not like the material world, where you're happy one day and the next day, oh my God, what was I thinking? Or, where did she go? Where did he go? Or, where did my money go? So, this is imperishable happiness. Then Krishna says, this is a very interesting verse. I still remember. I still remember when reading this verse in 1970. It might have been 1972. I had just taken sannyasa. It was 72, early 73. I was in Albany, New York, capital of New York, Albany, New York, and we were selling books. I was literally running around in ecstasy, running because I was young then, younger, and I was running around giving out Krishna books, little Krishna books. It was just so ecstatic. I was just running up to people and saying, you have to read about Krishna. And it was just so blissful that everyone thought, yeah, I have to read about Krishna. So I remember it was amazing back then with Prabhupada. I remember one time we took over a laundromat. You know what a laundromat is, right? Yeah, we were in Albany, New York, and so we were so bold, and we weren't bothered by useless considerations like what other people thought. So this is a laundromat by the university. There's a famous university there, the SUNY, S-U-N-Y, State University of New York in Albany. And so we were in this laundromat where the students go, and we had to wait for a close to, you know, and we couldn't waste time. Can't waste Krishna's time. And so we just sat and put a rug down, Persian rug or an Indian rug or a Vedic rug, and we started doing kirtan. And we just took over the laundromat. You know, everyone, it just turned into a Hare Krishna program. And all the students came, and then, you know, I gave my lecture. And I remember one time in Minneapolis. We were there in Minneapolis in the winter. It's like December. It gets cold there. I mean, seriously cold. But so one day, same thing went. What we would do is we would go and wash our clothes because we had all this laundry. We had a whole brahmachari party. I was sannyasi, and Satsarupa and I were traveling. and that program that Prabhupada liked so much. And so we put all our clothes in laundry, and then we would, like, they had a folding table, where you fold your clothes. So we had a red velvet cloth we put on it, and silver candle holders. And, you know, little altar pictures, parampara, panchatattva. So we used to set up, like, you know, in 2 minutes, set up an altar right there on the folding table of the laundromat. And this time we had so this is a big laundromat where, like, rows and rows of washers and dryers. And so we were, like, you know, we were young, just walking up and down the rows like in military discipline, chanting around, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, almost shaking our heads off our necks. You know, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna. And so some of these students came in, this is like, you know, 4:30 in the morning, 5 o'clock, and they probably, you know, just got out of a party or something. And they're coming in. They see these devotees and dhotis, you know, racing up and down between the washers and dryers. Anyway. So I remember in one such laundry leela, I think in that laundromat program we did, I actually spoke on this verse. So, yehi sansparsha ja bhoga dukkha yona ya evate adyanta vanta konteya nateshu ramate buddha. Is a fantastic verse. It means that those pleasures, bhoga, bhoga means like enjoyment, but not kosher. So those bhogas, you know, those pleasures which ja are born of contact between the senses and the sense objects. Like you see something, you hear something, you touch something, or you taste something, and so pleasures which come out of that contact. Krishna says, ironically, they're dukkha jonaya, they're the sources of unhappiness. And the word source, of course, is yoni, which also means womb, and therefore it also means the source. And so Krishna says these so-called pleasures are actually the source of suffering. Because he says, adyanta vanta konte, they have an adi, a beginning, like adi purusham, you know, the first. They have an adi and an anta, an end. They have a beginning and an end. And therefore, the Buddha, not the Buddha, but here it means an intelligent person. An intelligent person does not enjoy, take pleasure in those bhogas because they are actually sources of misery. They begin and they end. And the word for enjoy, does not enjoy in them, is ramate, the verb from which you get the course of the word rama, which means the source of pleasure. So, having said that, now we get to the verse that I was actually going to speak on. So, but don't panic, I'll end soon. Shaknoti haiva jaksodhum. So one who has the power, one who is able in this life, and Krishna says, iha eva, which means in this very life. One who has the power, who is able in this very life, sodhum, to tolerate and to tolerate it before giving up this body. And the word giving up here is vimokshana. Because the word moksha, or liberation, literally means like release, like letting go of something. So moksha means you're released from the material bondage. So here we have the word sharira, body. Sharira vimokshana. Before giving up the body, if you have the power to tolerate kama krododbhavam vegam. Vega, the impulse. Which, of course, Rupa Goswami uses this word, vacho vega manasakra. So if you can tolerate the impulse, that pushing, that impulse which arises from lust and anger. Lust and anger. If you can tolerate that impulse, then sa yukta. That person is yukta, connected, linked. The word yoga means link, and yukta means linked, linked, that you're actually connected to God. So that person is actually connected, and that person is happy. Sasuki nara. So the word for, like, to be able to have the power is, here the verb is shaknoti, which of course is the same verb from which you get the word shakti. Shakti means power. And so shaknoti means to have the power. So just like in English, we say to be able to do something. The verb is followed by the infinitive. I have the power to see, to hear, to tolerate. Same thing in Sanskrit. With that verb shak, like shakti, to have the power to do something, then it takes the infinitive afterwards. Which is, anyway, I could talk all day about Sanskrit grammar, but... Sodum. I won't even go into the irregularities of the formation of the infinitive suffix for that verb. So, but shaknoti, one who has the power to tolerate this vega, this driving force, this impulse, and you have the power to do it before you give up your body. In this very life, then you are happy and you actually are connected to Krishna. And of course, it's not all or nothing. I mean, if you're sort of tolerating, then you're sort of connected. And if you're flirting with toleration, but you haven't yet committed to toleration, but you're flirting with it, then you're kind of flirting with Krishna. So, then Krishna again, these verses are so interesting, the way Krishna develops these ideas, but he again stresses the internal as opposed to the external. The internal meaning, the real soul, the real you, the real person. And the external meaning, obviously, the fictitious identity that, you know, I'm this body. So then Krishna says, yo, one who is antak sukho, one who sukha, happiness, sukhot, that's something else. Right? Sukkot? I used to do that. I mean, I liked all that stuff. We used to, at our synagogue, we used to celebrate, what is that festival?
Sukkot.
Yeah, Sukkot. And they used to make these little cottages and hang all kinds of, you know, typical Israeli fruits and nuts and flowers because, you know, Southern California. And so it's just like here, same trees, same flowers, same, it's just the weather is very similar. And so I remember that we used to do that Sukkot. Anyway, that was a distraction. I still remember. So Krishna says, "Yo antar sukha, one whose happiness is within." Or one whose happiness is in the Sukkot. So, one whose happiness is within, under aramas, one whose enjoyment is within, in the soul. Tatha, and similarly, antar jyotir, one whose light, whose enlightenment is within. Eva jaha, sadyogi, that person is a yogi. Brahma nirvanam brahma bhuto digachati. This is so cool, the Bhagavad Gita. I mean, the way Krishna speaks, it's just, if you know Sanskrit, it's just, wow. It's just so interesting the way Krishna speaks. So, it says, and so that person is brahma bhuta. You know this term, like brahma bhuta, prasannatma, and so on. Bhu, in Sanskrit, means to exist, to be. In fact, the English word be, that be is from Sanskrit, bhavati. And so bhuta means one who has become, one who has become, one who has come to be. And so brahma bhuta means one has come to be Brahman. I mean, we are Brahman, but now we're an illusion. So we can't really enjoy our actual identity. So that person has come to be or now exists as a spiritual being. And achieves Brahman Nirvanam. Vana in Sanskrit means a current, like a wave in the water or a current of air. It's like a current, a flowing. And near means without. So what I say is, not I say, but if you study Buddhism, which has some, you know, very nice points, but they've always had a problem for 2,500 years, which has caused it's hard to work out, and that is that their ultimate goal is a grammatically negative word. In other words, if you say the ultimate goal is to be free of vana, which is what nirvana means, okay, I'm free from that, and I'm free to do what? And they're still discussing that. So, but here, Krishna has the positive term. Krishna uses the positive term Brahma Nirvana. So it tells you what you're free from and what you are free for or to do. So you're free from vana, that material current of birth and death, but you are free to enter into the absolute, the spiritual platform. So anyway, this Bhagavad Gita is just so spiritually pleasing. I mean, especially to see how Krishna is tying together all these points. And of course, I mean, I could go on till Sarvadharman Paritya. So, any questions on these points? Yes.
You mentioned that there are some people that it looks like they impose the idea of oneness on this world.
Yes.
They say we are all one.
Yes.
And they say, and it looks like they try to spiritualize this world without God. What's their idea exactly, and what can be said to them? The mistake? You can't really.
Okay. Say. Yeah, that's a good. So, if someone is in the bodily concept of life, they don't understand the soul, all they see is, it's just like, it's gross, actually, the bodily concept of life, if you think about it. And because the body, I mean, it's just flesh. Even the non-devotees, if let's say, God forbid, someone loses a limb, or like an arm, still, among people who are, let's say, decent and moral, they have this, you know, they say, no, it's still a full, complete person. That person is no less than anyone else. But actually, their body is less now. But yet, it's a complete person. So everyone really knows it, but they just avoid it. But if someone's in the bodily concept of life, and yet they still kind of want that oneness, that equality, so they try to find it in the body. And if someone says, like on the material platform, we're all equal, my simple question is, how do you know? Because if you give people tests, we find they're all different. People are all different. So materially, if you really believe in equality, you have to understand the soul. Because on the material level, we are not all equal. We're just not. I mean, any imaginable test you can give people, who can run faster, who can jump higher, who is better at math, who is better at science, at art, at, you know, anything. Any imaginable test will show that we're all different. And therefore, equality is actually a religious idea. And that's very interesting because they want to kill the goose that laid the golden egg. I don't know how you say it in Hebrew. Yeah. So, because the goose is the soul. We are equal because we're all souls. If you take away the soul, we are not equal, period. And if you say, yes, but even though our bodies are different, we still have equal dignity before the law, why? Why shouldn't a richer person get better justice? Why should not a more powerful person impose his or her will on the weaker? Why not? And if you say, because it's better for everyone if we don't, no, it's not. You know, you need to read history. There were plenty of dictators and tyrants that oppressed the people, stole everyone's money, raped all the beautiful women, and died in their sleep, you know, at a very old age. And so sometimes there's this appeal to social contract theory. Well, if everyone agrees to the social contract, you know, or they say something like materially absurd, like if one person isn't free, no one is free. Want to bet? It's just not true. There are some people, for example, who are in jail right now. But I'm not in jail. I'm really not in jail. I mean, from the material point of view. So, to say that if one person isn't free, no one is free is, of course, just a complete sentimental nonsense. It doesn't mean we don't care about the person that's not free. It doesn't mean that we don't try to help that person. But if you say that, ultimately, according to nature, it's in everyone's self-interest to follow the law, to be just. Actually, it's not. And a lot of people know it's not. And that's why there's so many cheaters in the world. And some people, and so if you say, well, if you kill your enemies, then there's a danger someone may kill you. And people say, okay, I'm a gambling man. I'm willing to take that risk. So what do you base justice on? If people are just bodies, if people are just two-legged animals, what's the basis of justice? What is, if you say equality, it's just, you're just babbling. It's just nonsense. Spiritually, it's not nonsense, but materially, it is nonsense. And that's why Thomas Jefferson, as I mentioned before, when he wrote the Declaration of Independence, you know, he was no fool. He knew philosophy. One time, there was a famous remark, John Kennedy, when he was president, he had a group of Nobel laureates to the White House for dinner. And he said, this is the greatest gathering of intelligence at a dinner in the White House since the time when Thomas Jefferson ate dinner alone. So, I mean, that's why Jefferson said that it's a self-evident truth that we are created equal, that endowed by the Creator. So the Creator is the goose that laid the golden egg of equality. So, we have to explain these things to people. Because materially, we're not equal. We are absolutely not equal. Anything else? Yes, Tali.
You said about being free from and to be free to.
Yes.
And you said that like in Nirvana, there is like a separation between being free from and being free to. I wondered when historically that happened, this separation in the inner self work or consciousness work. Because there are many people are targeting themselves to be free from.
Yes.
They don't consider to be connected to something else.
Yes, yes. Krishna has always taught that. So the knowledge is eternal, but if we are not, if we don't grab something positive, then we become free from something, but then there's a tendency to fall back. Because as Krishna says, actually Krishna talks about this in the second chapter, verse 59, is it? Where he says that, Vishaya, got it. Visaya vinivartante niraharasya dehinam. He says that among conditioned souls, souls that are in material bodies, dehinam, that if someone fasts, doesn't eat, nirahara, ahara means, you know, like eating or taking it. So someone just, and it's very interesting because ahara, just like the English word consume, can mean to eat, like to consume food, but also can mean to take in any type of material experience. And so ahara is just like that in Sanskrit. So nir, again, like nirvana, nirahara. Nirahara, ahara means literally taking in. And nirahara, not taking in the sense objects or fasting. So then Krishna says, among embodied souls, because you still have a body, but you are not taking in the sense objects or not eating, Then Krishna says, Vishaya, the sense objects, Vinivartante, they pull away from you. I mean, we know that. I mean, if you're fasting, if you just keep fasting, you are not going to feel any lust or any enthusiasm for anything. So, but the point is, just like, for example, this was often a strategy in among monks, monastic orders, where someone's like trying to be celibate and, oh my God, I'm so agitated. And so, okay, I won't eat. And just stop eating. And so this is what Krishna's talking about. That nivartante means to withdraw, to go away, and then vi, you know, specifically pull back. So vishaya, the sense objects recede, they pull away from you when you're not eating, because you're just like, you want to see a movie? No. Do you want to dance? No. It's like no, because you're fasting. But then Krishna says, rasavar jung. Rasopyasya. Krishna says the sense objects pull back, except there's one thing that actually doesn't go away. Varja means except. Except the taste for it. In other words, let's say someone's fasting, like as a strategy to decrease their lust. So they fast, and but then, that, you know, you fast and then you kind of get over, but then one really good meal and it's again the senses are you're back out there, because the lust, the taste is still there, and as soon as you eat again, it's back, it comes to life again, you know, again the beast comes to life. And therefore Krishna says that rasopyasya rasavarjam. But even your taste, even that rasa, which like that taste, parandrishtva nivartate, even that goes away upon literally seeing something greater. It's just like, let's say, for example, someone's in a relationship and they're very attached, and the other person one day says, I don't love you anymore. You know, I love Frederico. And so, so the person's heart is broken, so they may get drunk or take drugs or just trying to forget it or whatever. But you know, it's still there and they're still suffering. But then if they meet someone else who they like, oh, this person is so much more beautiful, I like this person so much more. And then the other person, oh, what was that person's name? You know, one minute you're suffering, you know, I'll never be happy again, no one knows how my pain. And then if you meet someone you like much better, you hardly remember that other person. And so this is what Krishna's talking about. Parang drishtva, on seeing, like really experiencing something greater, even that rasa goes away. So you fast, you just try to deny the sense objects, the sense objects kind of go away, but not your taste for it, but even that taste goes away when you experience something greater. And so that's the Brahma Nirvana. So you have to really give up stupid things, to really give up illusion, to really give up all that stuff. You have to have something better. You have to find something which makes you so happy, and that's Krishna consciousness.
So Buddhists,
yes,
don't believe that there is something much more better?
Well, they actually figured out approximately a few thousand years ago that this negative thing is not good, is not going to float the boat, as they say. And therefore, they, I'll explain it this way. I mean, imagine a rocket that takes off. You know, rocket takes off, but it doesn't have enough power to actually escape the Earth's gravity, the gravitational field. And so it goes up and then comes back to Earth. That's exactly the story of Buddhism. It originally began, I mean, one time 7-Up. You know, the drink 7-Up? They had a big commercial campaign, you know, 30 years ago. They called themselves the un-Coke. You know, we're the non-Coke. Unfortunately, people still kept drinking Coke, but Coca-Cola. So anyway, so Buddhism defined itself as the non-Vedic tradition. Because in the Vedic tradition, they have this Varna system, the social hierarchy. No, everyone's equal in Buddhism. That lasted a few weeks. And then they also said that, you know, you don't have to worship this or that. You're just, you know, basically, it was sort of like Shanti for dummies. In the sense of, you know, just like the four basic truths, that the four noble truths, that you're suffering. Never knew that. You're suffering because you're selfish. Stop being selfish and you'll stop suffering. If you want to stop being selfish, you know, practice Buddhism. Like right thinking, right speaking, right everything. And that was it. And that was the original program. And for a while it got some traction because at that time, inevitably, just like economically they say there are boom-bust cycles. You know what that is? Boom-bust. Boom, like an economic boom. Like when the economy goes way up. And then a bust. So they call it a boom-bust cycle, like economies. And religions have boom-bust cycles. So religions very successful, like the Vedic religion. Someone around here is really intelligent. So the idea is that there was this... The Vedic culture, of course, was the culture of India, and so it had no competition. So monopolies tend to become unresponsive to people's needs, right? It's like if you have the only food store in town, you don't like my food? Starve. You don't like my prices? Don't eat. And so, you know, monopolies. So there was this Vedic monopoly. And because of this, there was a lot of... Ultimately, it became sort of unresponsive and somewhat corrupted. And so there were various reactions to that about 2,500 years ago, which is also the time of Socrates and the time of Confucius in China, kind of the golden age of smart people. And so in India, there was a sort of a revolt against that. People wanted real spirituality. They wanted something which wasn't just this, like an oppressive caste system. And so that reaction, which scholars call the Shramana movements, because Shramana means kind of to really work hard at something. And so people really wanted real spiritual life. And so it took two forms. One form was within the Vedic culture. So within the Vedic culture, you had that response. People wanted more authentic spirituality, knowledge, not just rituals and so on. And so the people within Vedic culture that wanted to stay within it, they went out to the forest. And one of the words for forest in Sanskrit is aranya, like Naimisha aranya. And they wrote books, which are called aranyakas, or forest books. And then those turned into the Upanishads. And so, but then other people thought, I've had it, I'm out of here. They wanted to leave the Vedic culture altogether. And so they formed other groups like Buddhism or Jainism. But, I mean, in a sense, they were all the same generation. And they're all... So on the Buddhist side, because of that general discontent, because of that people were looking for something more, so there, if you just went around and said, hey, everybody, you know, join this religion and we don't have the caste system and it's about knowledge and about making you happy... It's like nowadays, there's so many programs and movements where you take just to make you happy and self-esteem and how to get past your problems and all that. You know, that's what it was like that. It's just like nowadays in the world, there's this proliferation of all these feel-good movements. You know, not a lot of philosophy, but you'll feel good. And it was the same thing. It was the same thing 2,500 years ago in India. So what happened is it took off and it became successful. Jainism actually was just as powerful as Buddhism back then. But then after a while, I mean, typically what happens is that the Vedic culture kind of reformed itself, got its act together, and started being responsive. Then you had, and then you had within the Vedic culture all these sages, the Upanishads, and this, and so, you know, the Buddhists, they were kind of losing their market. So therefore, they started taking back within Buddhism everything they'd given up. So you start to have, for example, Buddhist paradise. Paradise, by the way, is from Sanskrit. Paradise, paradisio in Latin, is paradesha, the land beyond. And so, I mean, imagine, I mean, just in the real world, I talked about this in my course in Florida. Imagine the real world. Let's say you're living in some little village, because almost everyone lived in villages. You're in some village in ancient India, and maybe someone you love has just passed away. Maybe, for example, your mother has passed away. And in that village, there are, you know, it's freedom of religion, and there's different preachers. Someone is, you know, trying to make you a Buddhist, and someone wants you to be Krishna conscious, whatever. And so if the Buddhist says, you know, here you are grieving, lamenting, you lost someone you love very much, and the Buddhist comes along and says, don't worry about it, because your mother didn't even exist. And it was just like an illusion, and there is no mother, and there is no person. Now are you satisfied? Not great grief counseling. So, and then meanwhile, someone from the Hindu side or the Vaishnav side says, no, your mother was a good soul, and now she's going to heaven, and she's getting all these rewards, and she's happy. Guess who you vote for? You know, which explanation is going to work for you? And that's exactly what happened. You could say religious market forces. Because India had a free market economy. And the market forces, whether it's about just capitalism, you know, producing, you know, the music market, like who wins the music awards, or whether it's a religious market, it's the same market forces. If you bring to the market what people want, they will buy your product.